This is NHL Radio.
Can't see nothing in front of me. Can't see nothing coming up behind. Make my way through this darkness. I can't feel nothing but this chain that binds me. Lost track of how far I've gone. Far I've gone, how high I've climbed, on the backs of 60-pound stones, on the shoulder half mile of line, come on up for the rising.
Time now for NHL Hour with Commissioner Gary Bettman on NHL Home Ice.
That was Bruce Springsteen. This is Gary Bettman with Bill Clement. Good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to the NHL Hour. We're coming to you live from the NHL store powered by Reebok on lovely 6th Avenue in Manhattan. We're on NHL Home Ice, XM 204, Sirius 208, and NHL.com. We'll be taking your calls, and the call-in number is 1-877-NHL on XM. That's 1-877-645-6696. We will get to your call shortly, and we're going to be joined later by the Senior Vice President of the Detroit Red Wings, Jim Devolano. Hello, Bill. How are you?
I'm fantastic, thank you. How are you?
I am just fine.
just another typical day, right? I mean, the camera crews outside and the media hordes that were hanging out waiting to, greet people on the way in and the way out. Obviously, you have something that you're going to say at some point about what happened today.
I assume that the camera crew is here to see you, following you around. You are the celebrity in town.
You know, I falsely assumed that, too, until I walked by them and they just kind of waved as I went by.
I don't know what camera crew passed who was trying to interview me, and I apologize because I couldn't stop because, you know, I only get here about 30 seconds before we take the air. So
yes,
I really didn't have time to do the interview. What we're alluding to for our listeners is obviously... we had a hearing with Sean Avery this morning, which was well chronicled by the media that it was going to happen. And I guess off the bat, what I need to say is I haven't made a decision yet. I want to take the opportunity to spend a little time thinking about what transpired at the hearing and everything that I was told and that needs to be considered. And I want to reflect on it, which means either sometime later this afternoon or tomorrow morning, we will render a decision, and I will make it public. This is one of those days where life gets in the way of doing this radio show, or this radio show gets in the way of doing the things that I need to sometimes do in the course of a day. And to make clear that we won't be ducking the issue next week, I will take all questions that people have on the subject. To the extent people have questions or they're seeking clarifications, I will be happy to discuss it next week. But long and short of it is, it would be inappropriate for me to be discussing either the event, the hearing, or anything related to what's been transpiring until I've made a decision.
See, we filled up 2 hours between noon and two on the subject, but then you arrived, and I understand why you can't.
Well, you have the luxury... Not when you're doing the show with me, but you have the luxury...
or on another day with you.
Yes, but you have the luxury of speculating and talking about it since I ultimately have the responsibility of making a decision here, and I take all of the disciplinary decisions and other decisions I make quite seriously. It's not something that I'm comfortable getting into until I've made a decision, and quite frankly, it's not even my comfort level. It wouldn't be appropriate for me to do it any other way than the way I'm handling
Agreed.
It.
Agreed. And that means, callers, put the Sean Avery issue on the shelf, at least until the commissioner gets back here next week. As Gary just said, we will address all of those issues, and at least he will honestly, fairly, objectively, as he's taken the time to do with this hearing situation right now. Lots to talk about, however, from the Winter Classic to the San Jose Sharks and the start that they have had to television ratings that look as if they're up just about across the board on a local level in the U.S., and to say nothing of who cooks the turkey at your home on Thanksgiving. How was Thanksgiving, by the way? We didn't have a show last week.
I knew I missed you. Last week
seems like a year ago.
Well, it's been a long week. Last week was the first Thanksgiving that we celebrated at home in 20 years.
Where do you usually celebrate?
We normally go to Vermont, where we've been going for more than 20 years. And we love spending Vermont with Thanksgivings in the mountains. The whole family gathers together and all the kids. My eldest child had her second child the week before, and we all decided in abundance of wisdom that young parents and older parents, such as grandparents, have, and that is we didn't think it was wise, necessary, or convenient to take a 8-day-old baby from New Jersey to Vermont, so we celebrated at home.
Good.
It was very nice.
Classic judgment.
Yeah, you know.
Well, you know, well done.
Age has certain benefits,
I'm
I
sure
suppose. But we're very excited. We now have two grandchildren, a little boy and a little girl, and it's all good.
Congratulations on that. Again, the phone number here, 877-645-6696. We're ready to answer your questions. Do you cook at all? Okay, we'll move on to the next question. We'll take that laughter as a no.
That would be accurate, and I don't clean either. But
windows? Give us something.
I eat really well. next Saturday night, Detroit plays Chicago, speaking of the Winter Classic. So that is an opportunity for me to shamelessly plug the Winter Classic on New Year's Day on NBC. On the CBC, on RDS, and there will be ample wraparound coverage before and after on the NHL Network and NHL Radio.
There you go. I was waiting for you to get to NHL Radio.
And yesterday in Chicago, last night, it was snowing and temperatures were in the teens, and that's all good.
What's the forecast?
I have no idea.
I
didn't look at the Farmer's Almanac. I don't want to get worried. It'll be what it'll be.
Some people are looking. Well, where is the prep given the fact that we are, three and a half weeks out? Approximately. Where is this Winter Classic preparation-wise compared to last year's?
It's underway. We have a ton of people in Chicago working on it as we speak. Today, by the way, on a different topic, is the 99th anniversary of the founding of the Montreal Canadiens. And so we now begin celebrating the centennial year. It's one of the reasons the All-Star Game is going to be there, the draft's going to be there. This is a truly remarkable franchise in a great city. And George Gillette, Pierre Beauvin, Bob Gainey have done a terrific job of re-energizing that city to this franchise. And so we're looking forward to being there. As you said, the Sharks are off to an amazing start.
Record-setting.
What are they, 21-3-1? Yeah, that's incredible.
No, the San Jose Sharks are that team that you see on your schedule right now and you start to shudder if you're a player, if you're a coach, or if you're an organization has to meet them. They're doing so many things right. And the television ratings are up there. We talked about that between noon and 2, Don LeGrec and I did, and how the local TV ratings in so many of the markets are up.
Mm-hmm. National ratings are up as well.
They are.
Yeah. No, we're off to a good start. Attendance is up as well. Two other things, and then we'll start taking calls. One of those has to do with the Sharks. I think they're 13-0-1 at home. So not only are they off to an incredible start, the Shark Tank is a great place to be to watch a game. It's incredible. And I want to send out our condolences to the family and loved ones of Pitt Martin, who died in a snowmobile accident.
It's tragic.
He played from 1961 to 1979 with the Blackhawks, the Red Wings, the Bruins, and the Canucks. Spent most of his career in Chicago and played with Papin and Hull. And I think there was a moment of silence in Chicago last night in his memory.
Rightfully so. He was just a classy player and a classy guy. That was just a tragedy, obviously.
So shall we move to the calls?
Why don't we?
Okay.
Ticket prices. Where do we want to start? We got ticket prices, rule changes, NHL teams in new markets. Check it out.
Let's see who's been holding the longest. And the winner of that is Fandy. Did you type that right? Fandy from Calgary. You're on with Bill and Gary, XM 204, Sirius 208.
How are you today?
We're good. How are you?
Terrific. Thank you. I wanted to talk a little bit about the rules. First of all, the rule changes, I want to say, have been great for the game. Absolutely no problem. We love to see the flow and all the action, and that's a wonderful thing. The one thing that still, to me, is a little concerning is the one-handed hooking that gets called. I don't like that, to be honest with you. And what I've always wondered why the NHL couldn't adopt a difference between penalties. In other words, the infractions, penalties for slashing, boarding, and those type of things, I've always believed that they should be two-minute non-terminating penalties, and the others could all be two-minute penalties that terminate with a goal. Is that something that could be considered? Because obviously there's a difference in an infraction when you hook somebody with one hand and you out-and-out trip them or knee them.
You know, it's an interesting question, and whether or not the minor penalties should be treated like the majors. In other words, as many goals as you can score in the amount of time you have on the penalty is limitless. And there hasn't been much appetite for that. 85% of the time penalties get killed anyway, so I'm not sure how much of a difference it would make. It's really just the minors where the goals are actually scored, where there's some time left that you'd have an opportunity to score again. I'm not sure scoring-wise it would make that much of a difference. Secondly, I'm not sure that I would like to make it any harder or create any greater disincentives for referees to raise their hand. I think they're getting it pretty right now, and why put them in a situation where they're not sure, thinking that the consequences are worse than they are currently used to in terms of how they call the game? The more important question that you asked is this notion of the one-hand hook. In order to open up the game coming back from the work stoppage, our view was we couldn't let interference get in the way of a scoring chance. And if you put your stick or you put your free hand on a player and you cause him to lose a stride, you may be breaking up a scoring opportunity, the opportunity to advance the puck in a way that will threaten the goaltender. And so in order to keep the game open, in order to get the clutching and grabbing and hooking and holding out of the game, the only thing we could do was make it clear that unless you had body position, you got to let the player go. And if you're getting beat, then you got to get beat, or you better skate harder, but you can't use your free hand to do it.
I love the free hand rule. I kind of understand what Fandy's talking about, because it does get to me sometimes, the one hand. I understand that it's in the rule book, and I understand the players have to conform.
And it looks like a cheap penalty. Like, why did they call it? What was so bad? But the fact is, and the competition committee is where we came up with this, and the players were very adamant on the subject. When you do that, by costing the player a stride, he maybe doesn't get that pass and get the chance to create a scoring opportunity.
I just, at the same time, it's easier to simulate having been interfered with for such a non-powerful gesture with the stick, that at the same time I think it's easy for a player, and believe me, the guys are the best in the world at simulating.
You know what, but the answer to that is, and you're right, and we don't like embellishment and we don't like diving, but if you're a player and you're playing D and you're getting beat and your stick goes horizontal or your hand goes out, you're putting yourself in the position to be vulnerable to have a bad call made against you.
True.
The stick doesn't belong up. The hand doesn't belong, in front of the guy like it looks like you're grabbing him. And if the official's out of position, and I acknowledge occasionally that happens, you may be setting yourself up for a bad call. So put your stick on the ice and keep your hands to yourself. End of story. But that was a good question. Why don't we go to Sean in Salt Lake City? You're on with Bill and Gary, Sirius 208, XM 204. Would you please get them to give us the same number? You there, Sean?
I'm here. Thanks, Commissioner, for taking my call.
It's our pleasure.
I had the opportunity of going to a preseason game here in Salt Lake City, which was awesome. And although I think we probably had the two wrong teams out here, not that you can have any two wrong teams, but I think as far as home teams being the Avs, the closest team. My question is, has the NHL possibly ever thought or explored the idea of maybe doing spring training similar to baseball, where regionally you maybe have groups of teams who perform their exhibition games or preseason games in training camps, sort of in areas where, I know I'm not going to ask you about the expansion opportunities because I know we're not expanding, but in markets like Vegas, Portland, Seattle, Hamilton, where they fans can be drawn and maybe over the course of a couple weekends attend a few games and, pick up the NHL fever. I'll take your comments offline.
Okay, I was going to ask you whether or not that exhibition game was at the East Center or the Delta Center, just as a matter of curiosity, but we'll hold that. You there?
Yeah, I'm sorry. It was, and, you know, I'm not a fan of the E-Center. It, as far as parking and, you know, only being able to hold 10,000 fans. But, I mean, it definitely had an NHL, you know, feeling to it. There was a lot of fans who were wearing their jerseys from, you know, Calgary, Edmonton, and, you know, just everywhere. It was awesome. But, I mean, I saw a lot of Red Wings jerseys, which we hated. But, you know, the Avalanche jersey certainly dominated the – you know, that team are that night. So anyway, I'll let you see if you've ever thought about exploring those possibilities.
I will do that. Interestingly enough, the E-Center, for our listeners, is where they played the games in the Olympics.
2002.
Exactly right. That's where the gold medal game was. With respect to training camp, our clubs don't all do their training camps in the same places, meaning at home. Some of them do it at home. Some go on the road. Off the top of my head, I think the Islanders go up to Lake Placid.
Detroit's in Traverse City.
Exactly right. And also some of the rookie programs, the rookie camps, there'll be four or six teams that will go to a particular location and play a number of exhibition games to try out their rookies and to see who they're going to invite to camp. So this notion of playing in other places is pretty common. And our teams, lots of them, play games in the preseason on the road in a variety of places that don't have NHL teams on a regular basis.
And I think for most teams it would have to stay there because it's a matter of facilities too. The off-ice training, the weight rooms, the medical facilities, there's so many other issues that have to accompany a team if they relocate for 2 or 3 weeks for a training camp. And logistically, it's a bear.
Well, it's a bear. And frankly, if you've got a team with a lot of players who don't live in the city in which they're playing, this is a time for them to move their families back in, get everybody home, get the kids into school, and just get everybody settled in. There's enough traveling in the course of the season that I know some organizations don't like to add to it in the preseason.
All right, we're going to step out. We appreciate your patience. This is NHL Home Ice's version of the NHL Hour, and you're listening to us on XM 204, Sirius 208, NHL.com. Back with Commissioner Bettman after this.
Rick Nash of the Columbus Blue Jackets, and you're listening to the NHL Hour with Commissioner Gary Bettman on NHL Radio. Now, back to Commissioner Bettman.
Thank you, Rick. Welcome back, everyone. It is my pleasure to introduce to our listeners Jim Devolano, who is the Senior Vice President of the Detroit Red Wings. And before we start talking, Jim, I'd like to give people a little bit of your background. This is Jim's 27th season with the Red Wings.
That is correct, Gary.
You were the first individual that Mike and Marion Ilitch hired when they bought the team in 1982.
Yes.
This is your 42nd season in the NHL.
That is correct.
You were the GM of the Red Wings when Steve Yzerman was drafted in 1983.
Yes, as it turns out, Gary, he was the very first person I selected, fourth overall in the 83 draft.
Good selection.
Yes, it turned out good.
that was, you know, and the funny thing is, you know, you living up to that standard might have been tough, but you managed to do it. But let me finish giving a little more of your remarkable background.
Well,
before the Red Wings, you were with Bill Torrey and the Islanders.
That is correct.
With the team that entered in 72 and drafted the core of the 1980 Islander dynasty.
Thank you, yes.
You have 14 championship rings, seven Stanley Cup, three Calder Cup, two Adams Cup, Central Hockey League, one Riley Cup, East Coast Hockey League, an American League championship ring as senior vice president of the 2006 Detroit Tigers.
Yes, that is correct, Gary.
So you wrote a book.
And I wrote a book, The Road to Hockey Town.
Okay, so how are you?
Well, I'm doing good, Gary. I'm doing good. I'm here in Sarasota, Florida. I'm about to get in my car and go up to Tampa to see the Lightning and the Boston Bruins tonight.
How many games do you get to a year?
Well, I, Gary, probably go to about 80, I would say, between Red Wing games. And I spend a fair amount of time now in Florida, so I get to all the Lightning games, Gary, and then a little earlier in the year I'm in Toronto and Buffalo. And I actually go up and scout the teams for our general manager, Ken Holland, for free agency and trades. So when I go to those games, I'm actually working.
How do you account for the incredible success and consistency of the Red Wings, particularly for a team that had one of the highest payrolls in the league before the salary cap and was able to adjust as seamlessly as it appears the club did?
Well, Gary, it really comes down to a wonderful, wonderful group of scouts that we have been most fortunate to put together. Jim Nill, who really kind of heads it up, Joe McDonnell, and a fabulous scout in Europe, Håkan Andersson. And really, you know, when we went into the new CBA, Gary, Ken Holland and I were very concerned, you know, that, you know, it might really inhibit us. But what happened was our scouts came up in late to middle rounds with guys that should have been taken in the top five of the draft, like a Pavel Datsyuk, a Henrik Zetterberg, a Johan Franzen. It really is incredible the job that our scouts have done, and I really, Gary, give them all the credit for the success that we have had after the you know, the lockout.
And you've been with the NHL, as I indicated before, in one capacity or another for 42 seasons. How has the league and the game changed during those four decades?
Gary, I think it's changed for the better. I think the hockey really is outstanding. I think it's just phenomenal how I've watched the league grow, Gary, from when I joined it. I've watched it grow from 12 teams to 30 and into southern markets. I'm going to a hockey game in Tampa tonight or Phoenix. And I just think it's great how the league has grown throughout the U.S., and it's been wonderful to see. It's a great league. It's a great sport, and the caliber of play, Gary, has really improved. I mean, guys skate so much faster and better today. The equipment is better, and I just think it's a great spectacle.
When you were a scout with the Blues in '67, when the league overnight doubled its size, what was that process like? It must have been a major upheaval to incorporate six new teams and, in effect, double the league in one fell swoop.
Well, it really was, Gary. What happened back in about 1965, there were two things that happened. There were some forward thinking presidents in the league, one in particular, Bill Jennings of the New York Rangers, and Stafford Smythe up in Toronto, and they worried about two things. They worried about a new league starting, but probably even more important than that, they thought that if ever they were going to get a footprint and get some television revenue, that they needed to be in more cities than which they were. And of course, it was just those original six way up there in the northeastern corridor. And so I think they did a novel thing. They put all six new teams. We were all put in one separate division. We played mostly within our division the first couple of years, but we would cross over occasionally. And of course, they'd always be big drawing games, you know, in the expansion cities. But eventually, you know, the schedule got balanced, the expansion teams improved, and you know, as you know, we went from 12 to eventually 30, and have the wonderful league that we have today.
We're talking to Jim Devolano of the Detroit Red Wings. Jim, you had mentioned the importance of scouting for the Red Wings' success. In the four-plus decades you've been in the game, how has scouting changed?
Well, when I started, Gary, in 1967, I was 24 years old, and I was the Ontario scout for the St. Louis Blues, and that's kind of how I got started. And back in 1967, the NHL, even as a new 12-team league, were all Canadians. I mean, forget Europe. When an American boy played in the NHL, it was big news. I can remember there was one kid by the name of Charlie Burns who made the Detroit Red Wings in about 1958-59, and that was big news. Then what happened as we got into the 70s, the U.S. colleges started to produce players, and I found myself, I now was with the New York Islanders, and I found myself now going into U.S. colleges and actually finding some hockey players. And we did find some for the New York Islanders, a kid like Kenny Morrow, Dave Langevin, just two as an example. So through the 70s now, the U.S. colleges and junior leagues were now starting to produce players. Then when we got into the early 80s, we started to look a little further and we went into Europe. Finland, Sweden, you could get players out. Obviously, there was an Iron Curtain with Russia and Czechoslovakia, and you couldn't get players out, but you were able to draft them and keep them on your reserve list. So I would say to you, in summation, Gary, when I started 42 years ago, we strictly scouted across Canada, and that's where all the players came from. In the 70s, the United States started to hook on to hockey. College programs and junior leagues developed, and then into the 80s we got into Europe, and now we have this great, great, great global sport.
How much of a difference has technology made in scouting?
Well, a little bit, Gary, I suppose. You know, although I'm still kind of an old-fashioned guy, a lot of clubs are doing things with computers, and our club is even today. But at the end of the day, Gary, I don't know if anything beats going to the game, seeing the player, finding out a little bit about his background, and you know, using kind of your gut and your eyesight to make a judgment on a player. But like with everything, Gary, yes, technology certainly has entered into the fray.
Before we change subject from scouting, in the course of all the scouting you've done, what are the most unusual places, most unusual rinks that you've ever been to?
Well, very interesting. There's a city about 600 miles north, Gary, if you can believe this, north of Winnipeg, and I've spent some time up there, Flin Flon, Manitoba. Of course, Bobby Clark.
Yes.
Played in Flin Flon, but I made a few trips up there, and they had a junior club called the Flin Flon Bombers. They actually did produce several NHL players, and I can remember going up there, and it would be 30 degrees below zero, and you'd go into this rink with no heat. There was frost on the walls. It was two rows of seats, but they actually produced hockey players, a little mining town 600 miles north of Winnipeg. Some other funny places I went to were places in Quebec where people didn't speak English, Chicoutimi, Three Rivers. And for somebody that didn't speak French, it was a little intimidating, you know, being in those places. But those are certainly two places that were different for different reasons.
Notwithstanding your long and stellar career in hockey, you've also got a great interest and knowledge of baseball. Did you ever think you'd be at an NHL game at Wrigley Field?
Unbelievable. I am so excited about it, Gary. I can't contain myself. I think it's fantastic what you and Rocky Wirtz and the people in the league are doing, and I'm very excited about it. Of course, being an executive in baseball with the Tigers and having been a baseball fan and gone to Wrigley Field, it's just such an intimate, famous place. I think it's just going to be marvelous. And Gary, I hope that you and your league can eventually do it at a place maybe like Yankee Stadium or Fenway Park. I think it's a great way to take our great league and sport to people that normally wouldn't watch a hockey game.
Well, that's part of the intent, although we do like taking the game back to its roots, namely outdoors. You omitted Comerica Park while you were listing the places we might want to play. Hey, but while we're talking about the outdoor game, you know, the Blackhawks and the Red Wings have one of the great rivalries in all of sports. What about that rivalry stands out for you?
Oh, it's a great rivalry. Of course, when I arrived in Detroit, Gary, and of course the reason I got the job was that the Red Wings had really fallen onto hard times. And at that particular time, the Blackhawks really had a good team. And in my early years, I can remember them really kicking the crap out of us. they had good hockey clubs, and we weren't so good. And then, you know, things, as they always do, they reverse. And, of course, we did a little bit of that in recent years, obviously, to the Blackhawks. But I will say this, Gary, they've got a good hockey club now. They've patiently drafted well with some good young players. Seem to be really organized and running very well, and it's good to see. We have a real rivalry now with Chicago, and it's going to really heat up because they've got a good hockey club, and they're coming after us, and so... It'll be good. You know, fans can travel between the two cities. We've got Chicago at Joe Louis Arena this Saturday night, and there's a lot of Chicago fans have bought tickets and come over, and we'll have the sellout on Saturday night. So we've played, I think, about 600 times in our career, and so it's a great geographical rivalry, and now it's a good rivalry on the ice. Because of the rival, you know, because of the improvement in the Blackhawks.
We're talking to Jim Devolano. Jim, I had mentioned early on that you have 14 championship rings. Is there any one championship that you've been involved in that stands out or is more special to you than any of the others?
Gary, I'd say two, and I'll explain why. The first one was our first Stanley Cup on Long Island, 1980, May 24th. Gary, I joined Bill Torrey as one of his early hires to be his head recruiter in 1972, and here we were, an expansion team, and 8 years later winning a Stanley Cup. I didn't think it was possible. We had a lot of luck. We had a lot of good fortune. We had a great coach in Al Arbor and some great hockey players, and winning that Stanley Cup in our eighth year of existence was just a phenomenal, phenomenal thing. And I knew then that I would have two things. My name would be on the Stanley Cup, which means so much to a young boy growing up in Canada, and I would get a Stanley Cup ring, and that to me was just the greatest. The other ring that is very, very special to me is the 1997 Red Wings, our first Stanley Cup in, I will call it, the Mike and Marion Ilitch era. Being the first employee that the Ilitches hired, I can always remember in talking to the Ilitches, and they made the decision to hire me, Mike Ilitch said to me, Gary, he said, how long will it take you to win the Stanley Cup? And I said, well, we'll do it in 8 years, just like we did with the Islanders. And I remember Marion saying to me, Jimmy, 8 years? I'm going to be an old lady. I won't even be able to go out onto the ice. Well, as it turns out, it took 15, Gary, to win the first one. It took 15 years, albeit we had some good teams prior to that. But it took 15 years, and with that cup in 97, for me, Gary, it was a sense of real relief and joy that we finally were able to win the Stanley Cup. We didn't do it quite as quickly as I'd promised, but we did get the job done, and we've won a few since then, so kind of made up for it.
I was going to say, you may have taken a little longer, but I think you've made up for it with the number of times. A couple of more questions, and I'll let you go, Jim. You just wrote a book, The Road to Hockey Town. In the book, you list three rules that you believe are critical for any young person who wants to be a general manager. One, to prioritize good drafting. Two, to hire the best people available at all positions. And three, remember that sports is a business and must operate that way. Would you elaborate on your thinking?
Well, for sure, Gary. You know, any of the success that I have been associated with in our great league, Gary, really came down to the players. And the only way I know that you can get star players really is through the draft. It's very rare that you can trade for a star player. I guess now with a little more liberal free agency, you can sign some. But most of my career, you had to draft them, whether it was Dennis Potvin or Mike Bossy or Brian Trotsky or Steve Yzerman or Sergei Fedorov. So I have always felt it crucial to have top-notch scouts and really make drafting a priority. I've also thought that it was very important in my career to do what Bill Torrey did for me, and that's develop some good young people from within. And Bill Torrey gave me that opportunity to learn and to flap my wings a little bit with the Islanders, and I would like to think that I brought that to the Red Wings with young Ken Holland now, who is I'm so proud of, and it's turned out to be such a great general manager, Jim Neal, who works along with Kenny, and now, of course, Steve Yzerman. And it's just so wonderful to see these young people learn and try things and do things and take on responsibility. So surround yourself with good quality people that are dedicated to the game. And, you know, we have been fortunate to do that. And what was the third thing, Gary, that I...
Remember that sports is a business.
Yeah, it's a business. There's no question about it, and you have to. And I'd like to, you know, one of the things that I take pride in is the fact that, and one of the reasons I think that I've lasted as long in Detroit is because I have tried to respect my owner's money. You know, have just tried to run it as best we could as a business. And as you know, Gary, a lot of that comes from ownership. You know, they kind of dictate, obviously, how they're going to run their team. But it is a business. I think it should be run as a business. And probably now more than ever with the salary cap and revenue sharing, most teams now are running it more like a business.
Last question, Jim. Most interesting person you've met in all your time in the NHL?
Wow, that is wow. Well, I've met a lot of interesting people. You know, Scotty Bowman, Bill Torrey, certainly Mike and Marian Ilitch. You know, there's just so many. Al Arbor. You know, I could probably give you a list of 20 people, you included, Gary.
Well, let's not go there, my friend.
No, a lot of interesting people. You know, 42 years, Gary, in the league, you work with and you work for a lot of people, and there have been a lot of very interesting people and characters that I've run into.
Jim, thank you so much for making time to be with us. Enjoy the game tonight, and I'm sure we'll see you around soon.
Yeah, for sure, Gary. We'll see you at the meetings, and thanks for having me on.
Thank you. That was Jim Devolano, Senior Vice President of the Detroit Red Wings.
Learned something there. 14 rings? Is that what it is? 14 rings.
14 rings.
Unbelievable. What a story. I imagine it's an interesting book, too. I got to grab a copy of that. Time to step up to the plate. I'll give you the phone number again, 877-645-6696. 645-6696 here on the NHL Hour. Commissioner Gary Bettman preparing to answer your questions when we come back.
Hi, this is Sidney Crosby, the Pittsburgh Penguins, and you're listening to NHL Hour with Commissioner Gary Bettman on NHL Radio. Now back to Commissioner Bettman.
That's quite a classic combo, Sid Crosby and the Doors. It's all good.
It's all good.
It's all good.
A little juxtaposition there. It was Jimmy Morrison and Sidney Crosby. Sidney Crosby's such a clean cut, clean liver, and the last time I checked, Jim Morrison wasn't so.
Well, that's a whole other story. I meant the music. I wasn't talking about lifestyle. But we have a couple of people who have been holding on for a half hour, and I think we should get to them. So let's start with Frank in Connecticut. You're on XM 204, Sirius 208, Gary and Bill.
Hi, Gary and Bill. It's an honor and a privilege to be able to talk to both of you, two incredible hockey people.
Thank you. Thanks.
I'm a New York Rangers season ticket holder that commutes about 2.5 hours to every game from Hartford, so by no means am I a small fan. I'm a huge hockey person. I love hockey for many years, back when we had the Whalers in Hartford. My question to you, before the lockout, you talked, I believe you used the language about getting healthy and the need for a salary cap to keep things under control. You got the salary cap, yet my tickets were $36 the year after the lockout, and now they're $56 a game, okay? That seems like a pretty huge increase, yet the salaries are being kept down. That was the first question I wanted to ask you about. Second, you've had some regular season games overseas. Every year I'm made to pay for 3 preseason games, which I commute 2.5 hours to Madison Square Garden, and yet I go there to a very boring environment where the garden is half full because people over here don't really care to see the preseason game. Any thoughts of possibly having these preseason games overseas so that, the games that we're paying for over here could be regular season games? So I guess I have 2 questions for you there.
Both good questions, both fair, and let me try and address them in reverse order. What teams choose to do in terms of playing preseason games, how they schedule them, how many they have at home, that's an individual club decision, and there are a variety of factors that go into it, including the amount of travel that the team does or doesn't want to do. Our belief in terms of trying to respond to the interest in our game in Europe, where we're about a third, about 28% of our players, some of the best players in the world, come from, it was a knowledgeable hockey market. And since we were dealing with markets where there weren't particular rooting interests and there was a great deal of hockey knowledge, we felt that the only way we could make an impact, and we only do it with a handful of games in Europe, would be to play regular season games that counted in the schedule. We didn't think that exhibition games would have quite the same impact for us for the European games. With respect to your first question, in terms of ticket prices, there are a couple of things. One, again, the league doesn't set ticket prices. That's an individual club decision. What I think is interesting, if I have my facts right with respect to the Rangers, is when they were going through the long drought of not making the playoffs, they weren't raising ticket prices at all. And so the $36 ticket price you were referring to was probably a ticket price that had been in effect 5-6 years without an increase. What I said going into the lockout and coming out was that having a salary cap would reduce the pressures from inflation, the inflationary spiral. And in fact, that's true. I think our average increase in ticket prices since the lockout has been something like 1-2%, well below the other 3 major sports leagues in terms of what their ticket price increases have been. The cost of operating a team have gotten more expensive. When the price of gasoline was up to $5 a gallon, the travel costs attendant to moving our clubs around were going through the roof. And inflation in most businesses is a fact of life. But having said that, our inflationary pressures were not being pushed the way they were before the work stoppage because of player salaries, because now that they're linked to revenues, you don't have the same pressures. I know there are a number of people who have suggested I said ticket prices wouldn't go up at all. I never said that. What I said was the increases would be much more moderate than they would otherwise be. And that has, in fact, been the case if you look at what our average ticket price is now compared to what it was when we came back from the lockout. That is league-wide, however. Some clubs lowered their ticket prices, some haven't raised them, and some have raised them. And again, that depends on the circumstances of each club. And again, as I said, that's a local club decision.
What a fan, though. 2.5-hour drive.
Great fan.
Unbelievable.
But that's what hockey fans are like. More connected to our game than perhaps the fans of any other sport. Let's go to Jim in Pennsylvania. You're on XM 204, Sirius 208, and you're with Bill and Gary.
Hi. It's great talking to you guys. I really find it to privilege to get on the air. I wasn't sure if I was going to be able to today.
Listen, you held on for over a half hour. We were going to do everything we could to get to you.
I appreciate that. Before my comment, though, I do have a question for you, and I was wondering about those amazing sharks right now. Is Gordon Gund still associated with them?
Gordon is no longer the owner of the club. There's a local group, Greg Jameson, who's the president of the club, put together, and I think they have an ownership group of about 8 or 10 people, primarily people who are local to the Bay Area. George and Gordon, great sports owners. Gordon was and is passionate about the Sharks, but I think he's spending his time now doing other things.
Okay, I had met him in California one time at a conference because he has retinitis pigmentosa disease, you know, with the eyes, and I have the same thing.
That's Gordon. George was the one.
Yes.
Gordon was primarily focused on the Cleveland basketball team, which they own together, and George was more involved with hockey, but both great sports owners. And we do a lot of work on behalf of RP to this day with Gordon. We have the Fighting Blindness League each year before the start of the playoffs, where we do basically a fantasy league in a number of different club cities. We have a dinner, people come in, and they do a mock draft, and they give out the Gun Cup to the winner of the RP Fighting Blindness League.
Right, and I thought that was such a great effort, you know, that was, you know, and I didn't know if he was still involved somehow in all of that. But my comment was that I just wanted to say, you know, thank you for the league and for you guys, everybody involved in having such a class act organization through just what's going on now, but as well as so many other things. I think it really sets the sport apart from other sports. And just the way that a lot of the players handle themselves as well as management, just the fact that I'm sitting in my garage and talking with the commissioner of the NHL, you know, the accessibility to people in the organization is amazing. And the effort of Hockey Fights Cancer is just tremendous. And I personally want to thank you. My daughter was diagnosed a few years ago, and she's doing well, but that, you know, reaches out to so many people. And the efforts of, I'm not sure if you're familiar with the Hockey This Morning guys and Sean Levine and the Locks of Love and all that. It was just tremendous, and I think, you know, you got to give you guys a great big thank you for that.
Well, thank you, and obviously we wish you and your daughter both well and good health going forward. Both causes, fighting RP, fighting blindness, and fighting cancer, are near and dear to this league's heart. And we're committed to doing the things we can do to help fight these medical conditions. Why don't we go to Ken in Tampa? You're on with Bill and Gary. This is XM 204, Sirius 208.
Commissioner and Bill, thank you for taking my call. Commissioner, I think it's admirable that you stick to this radio show and make it a priority in your day when you could have very easily taken a pass to deal with obviously bigger issues. But the fans appreciate it. And I just want to let you know that.
Well, thank you. Thank you. And you know, and you hit it right, but with one little caveat. Having interaction with fans like we're doing now is as important as anything else I get to do.
That's great. Well, I too, like Jimmy Devolano, I'm driving from Orlando to the game in Tampa. I'm a season ticket holder for the Lightning.
Great.
160-mile round trip. My question is, where is Orlando on the hockey radar? I know expansion is not imminent, but we are the largest market in North America without professional hockey at any level. We used to have minor league teams. We're just sort of like a sports orphan down here. We have no pro baseball, second largest market, television market without the NFL behind Los Angeles. Is hockey on the radar? We're getting a brand new building for the Orlando Magic. Does the NHL prefer separate buildings for their teams? What would it take, hypothetically, for an NHL team to someday end up in Orlando?
You know, that's an interesting question, and up until this moment, I hadn't thought about it because nobody has expressed an interest to us in owning a team in Orlando. Of all the expressions of interest we get from all over North America, Orlando, for whatever reason, doesn't happen to be a place that's been knocking on our door.
Ken want to own a team?
Well, you know,
I would love to. There's a couple of billionaires running around town in Orlando.
You should talk to. Oh, actually, how big's the credit line on your credit card? The seriously though, you know, I think part of it is nobody's focused on it because my understanding is that there's been a struggle effort to get a new arena, which has taken a long time to get.
It's in the ground. It's coming out of the ground right now. There's concrete exposed.
There was an IHL team there, the Solar Bears, for a while, and that relocated.
Right.
You know, I know that Orlando's a vibrant, growing market, but candidly, of all the places we hear from of people wanting to own a club, Orlando hasn't been one of them. How many games a year do you get to in Tampa?
I have a full season package over there. I don't get to all 41 home games, but I try. It's a little difficult, but my wife and I love hockey. This is my sixth professional hockey team as a season ticket holder in six different leagues. I started with the old Cleveland Barons in the AHL, and you mentioned the Gunn brothers. They had the Cleveland Barons in the NHL. So I just love to follow hockey around, but I wish it was a little closer to home.
Well, welcome to the NHL, and thanks for being such a great fan.
Will the technology of the Winter Classic allow you to come down to Orlando, maybe the Lightning and the Panthers and the Citrus Bowl?
You may be taxing us beyond our ice-making capabilities. Interesting thought, though. Hey, thanks a lot, and enjoy the game.
Thanks.
Pat in Detroit, you're on with Bill and Gary. XM 204, Sirius 208.
Yeah, how you doing, Gary?
Great. And you?
Not too bad. Got a question regarding the offsides on the face-offs, where players are constantly violating the face-off circle. You know, the wingers are encroaching in on the circle all the time. They don't seem to call that the offsides, I mean, or throw the center out of the face-off circle on the team that violates the circle. It seems like if you watch a game anymore, just about every face-off, somebody's creeping in or trying to get an advantage, or the players are leaning on each other, and it just seems like that rule or part of the game has just been overlooked.
You know, it's an interesting thing. I haven't heard many complaints about this, and I know...
Nor have I.
This is something that hockey operations monitors. I have to talk to Coley Campbell to see if he thinks it's been much of an issue. If I'm not mistaken, though, we went to face-offs in the face-off circles this year as opposed to just dropping the puck in an approximate location from where the stoppage of play was, with the intent of getting better face-offs with more integrity.
Right.
And so hearing that you don't think it's happening, that's something we have to follow up on, because, frankly, that's not something I've noticed, and that's not something our guys in hockey ops have either noticed or pointed out to us, but we will take a look at it.
Yeah, it's been something I've noticed a lot lately, where I'll watch a game, and it seems like just about every face-off, someone's cheating or trying to get into the circle, and even when they do stop a play because of it, it seems like that very few times they'll actually throw somebody out of the circle, or even, you know, for that matter, call a delay of game penalty if it happens more than once.
When I get off the air, I'm going to call Coley and see if this is something that's become an issue that we need to be following. Obviously, it's not about a rule change. It's about the standard of enforcement with respect to an existing rule. And if we're slipping, and again, I'm not sure that anybody else thinks we are, but I'll take a look at it. It's a good observation from the caller.
Have you seen the tree? I walked over today when I had a couple of hours.
You had nothing else to do?
2 hours between 2 and 4.
One of us was busy today.
Well, it was only lit last night, right?
I saw it before it was lit, and last night I was in the office till about 8:30, realizing that I had to get out of here before they lit it at 9, where there would be 100,000 people that I'd have to make my way through to get home.
Check it out. It's way better lit.
I'm sure it is.
All right. That's going to do it for the NHL Hour. We appreciate all of your calls, all of your comments, and above all, the loyalty of all of the hockey fans out there. Coming up next, Phil Esposito and Mike Ross are in the slot. We will be back next Thursday at 4 Eastern. Have a great week of hockey, and we'll see you next Thursday.
For more podcasts, check out NHL.com. This is NHL Radio.